smiled at me. I can't tell you how much I look forward to coming back to Charleston. We should hold all our reunions here. I knew how much Nina loathed this city and this house.
Willie would be hurt, I said. You know how he likes to show off his place in Beverly Hills, and his new girlfriends.
And boyfriends, Nina said, laughing. Of all the changes and darkenings in Nina, her laugh had been least affected. It was still the husky but childish laugh that I had first heard so long ago. It had drawn me to her then, one lonely adolescent girl responding to the warmth of another as a moth to a flame. Now it served only to chill me and put me even more on guard. Enough moths had been drawn to Nina's flame over the many decades.
I'll send for tea, I said.
Mr. Thorne brought the tea in my best Wedgwood china. Nina and I sat in the slowly moving squares of sunlight and spoke softly of nothing important, mutually ignorant comments on the economy, references to books that the other had not gotten around to reading, and sympathetic murmurs about the low class of persons one meets while flying these days. Someone peering in from the garden might have thought he was seeing an aging but attractive niece visiting her favorite aunt. I drew the line at suggesting that anyone would mistake us for mother and daughter. People usually considered me a well-dressed, if not stylish, person. Heaven knows I have paid enough to have the wool skirts and silk blouses mailed from Scotland and France. But next to Nina, I've always felt dowdy. This day she wore an elegant light blue dress that must have cost several thousand dollars. The color made her complexion seem even more perfect than usual, and brought out the blue of her eyes. Her hair had gone as gray as mine, but somehow she managed to get away with wearing it long and tied back with a single barrette. It looked youthful and chic on Nina, and made me feel that my short artificial curls were glowing with a blue rinse. Few would suspect that I was 4 years younger than Nina. Time had been kind to her, and she had fed more often. She set down her cup and saucer and moved aimlessly around the room again. It was not like Nina to show such signs of nervousness. She stopped in front of the glass display case. Her gaze passed over the Hummels and the pewter pieces, and then stopped in surprise. "Good heavens, Melanie! A pistol? What an odd place to put an old pistol!" "It's an heirloom," I said. "A Colt peacemaker from right after the war between the states." "Quite expensive." "And you're right, it is a silly place to keep it. But it's the only case I have in the house with a lock on it, and Mrs. Hodges often brings her grandchildren when she visits."
"You mean it's loaded?"
"No, of course not," I lied. "But children should not play with such things."
I trailed off lamely. Nina nodded, but did not bother to conceal the condescension in her smile. She went to look out the south window into the garden.
Damn her. It said volumes about Nina that she did not recognize that pistol.
On the day he was killed, Charles Edgar Larchmont had been my beau for precisely 5 months and 2 days. There had been no formal announcement, but we were to be married. Those 5 months had been a macrocosm of the era itself, naive, flirtatious, formal to the point of preciosity, and romantic. Most of all, romantic. Romantic in the worst sense of the word, dedicated to saccharine or insipid ideals that only an adolescent, or an adolescent society, would strive to maintain. We were children playing with loaded weapons. Nina, she was Nina Hawkins then, had her own beau, a tall, awkward, but well-meaning Englishman named Roger Harrison. Mr. Harrison had met Nina in London a year earlier, during the first stages of the Hawkinsons' grand tour.
declaring himself smitten, another absurdity of those times, the tall Englishman had followed her from one European capital to another, until after being firmly reprimanded by Nina's father, an unimaginative little milliner who was constantly on the defensive about his doubtful social status, Harrison returned to London to settle his affairs. Some months later, he showed up in New York just as Nina was being packed off to her aunt's home in Charleston in order to terminate yet another flirtation. Still undaunted, the clumsy Englishman followed her south, ever mindful of the protocols and restrictions of the day. We were a gay group. The day after I met Nina at Cousin Celia's June ball, the four of us were taking a hired boat up the Cooper River for a picnic on Daniel Island. Roger Harrison, serious and solemn on every topic, was a perfect foil for Charles's irreverent sense of humor. Nor did Roger seem to mind the good-natured jesting, since he was soon joining in the laughter with his peculiar haw-haw-haw. Nina loved it all. Both gentlemen showered attention on her, and although Charles never failed to show the primacy of his affection for me, it was understood by all that Nina Hawkins was one of those young women who invariably becomes the center of male gallantry and attention in any gathering. Nor were the social strata of Charleston blind to the combined charm of our foursome. For 2 months of that now distant summer, no party was complete, no excursion adequately planned, and no occasion considered a success unless we four were invited and had chosen to attend. Our happy dominance of the youthful social scene was so pronounced that cousins Celia and Lorraine wheedled their parents into leaving 2 weeks early for their annual August sojourn in Maine. I am not sure when Nina and I came up with the idea of the duel. Perhaps it was during one of the long, hot nights when the other slept over, creeping into the other's bed, whispering and giggling, stifling our laughter when the rustling of starched uniforms betrayed the presence of our colored maids moving through the darkened halls. In any case, the idea was the natural outgrowth of the romantic pretensions of the time. The picture of Charles and Roger actually dueling over some abstract point of honor relating to us thrilled both of us in a physical way that I recognize now as a simple form of sexual titillation. It would have been harmless, except for the ability. We had been so successful in our manipulation of male behavior, a manipulation that was both expected and encouraged in those days, that neither of us had yet suspected that there was anything beyond the ordinary in the way we could translate our whims into other people's actions. The field of parapsychology did not exist then, or rather, it existed only in the rappings and knockings of parlor game seances. At any rate, we amused ourselves for several weeks with whispered fantasies, and then one of us, or perhaps both of us, used the ability to translate the fantasy into reality. In a sense, it was our first feeding. I do not remember the purported cause of the quarrel. Perhaps some deliberate misinterpretation of one of Charles's jokes. I cannot recall who Charles and Roger arranged to have serve as seconds on that illegal outing. I do remember the hurt and confused expression on Roger Harrison's face during those few days. It was a caricature of ponderous dullness, the confusion of a man who finds himself in a situation not of his making and from which he cannot escape. I remember Charles in his mercurial swings of mood, the bouts of humor, periods of black anger, and the tears and kisses the night before the duel. I remember with great clarity the beauty of that morning. Mists were floating up from the river and diffusing the rays of the rising sun as we rode out to the dueling field. I remember Nina reaching over and squeezing my hand with an impetuous excitement that was communicated through my body like an electric shock. Much of the rest of that morning is missing. Perhaps in the intensity of that first subconscious feeding, I literally lost consciousness as I was engulfed in the waves of fear, excitement, pride, of maleness, emanating from our two bows as they faced death on that lovely morning. I remember experiencing the shock of realizing this is really happening as I shared the tread of high boots through the grass. Someone was calling off the paces. I dimly recall the weight of the pistol in my hand. Charles's hand, I think. I will never know for sure. And a second of cold clarity before an explosion broke the connection, and the acrid smell of gunpowder brought me back to myself. It was Charles who died. I have never been able to forget the incredible quantities of blood that poured from the small round hole in his breast. His white shirt was crimson by the time I reached him. There had been no blood in our fantasies, nor had there been the sight of Charles with his head lolling, mouth dribbling saliva onto his bloodied chest, while his eyes rolled back to show the whites like two eggs embedded in his skull. Roger Harrison was sobbing as Charles breathed his final, shuddering gasps on that field of innocence. I remember nothing at all about the confused hours that followed. The next morning, I opened my cloth bag to find Charles's pistol lying with my things. Why would I have kept that revolver? If I had wished to take something from my fallen lover as a sign of remembrance, why that alien piece of metal? Why pry from his dead fingers the symbol of our thoughtless sin? It said volumes about Nina that she did not recognize that pistol. "Willie's here," announced Nina's amanuensis, the loathsome Miss Barrett Kramer. Kramer's appearance was as unisex as her name, short-cropped black hair, powerful shoulders, and a blank, aggressive gaze that I associated with lesbians and criminals. She looked to be in her mid-30s.
"Thank you, Barrett, dear," said Nina.
Both of us went out to greet Willie, but Mr. Thorne had already let him in, and we met him in the hallway.
"Melanie, you look marvelous. You grow younger each time I see you."
"Nina." The change in Willie's voice was evident. Men continued to be overpowered by their first sight of Nina after an absence. There were hugs and kisses. Willie himself looked more dissolute than ever. His alpaca sports coat was exquisitely tailored. His turtleneck sweater successfully concealed the eroded lines of his wattled neck. But when he swept off his jaunty sports car cap, the long strands of white hair he had brushed forward to hide his encroaching baldness were knocked into disarray. Willie's face was flushed with excitement, but there was also the telltale capillary redness about the nose and cheeks that spoke of too much liquor, too many drugs.
"Ladies, I think you've met my associates, Tom Luar and Jensen Reynolds."
The two men added to the crowd in my narrow hall. Mr. Luar was thin and blonde, smiling with perfectly capped teeth. Mr. Reynolds was a gigantic Negro, hulking forward with a sullen, bruised look on his coarse face. I was sure that neither Nina nor I had encountered these specific cat's paws of Willie's before. It did not matter. "Why don't we go into the parlor?" I suggested. It was an awkward procession, ending with the three of us seated on the heavily upholstered chairs surrounding the Georgian tea table that had been my grandmother's.
"More tea, please, Mr. Thorne."
Miss Kramer took that as her cue to leave, but Willie's two pawns stood uncertainly by the door, shifting from foot to foot and glancing at the crystal on display, as if their mere proximity could break something. I would not have been surprised if that had proved to be the case.
"Yes,"
Willie snapped his fingers. The Negro hesitated and then brought forward an expensive leather attaché case. Willie set it on the tea table and clicked the catches open with his short, broad fingers.
"Why don't you two see Mrs. Fuller's man about getting something to drink?"
When they were gone, Willie shook his head and smiled apologetically at Nina.
"Sorry about that, love."
Nina put her hand on Willie's sleeve. She leaned forward with an air of expectancy.
"Melanie wouldn't let me begin the game without you. Wasn't that awful of me to want to start without you, Willie dear?"
Willie frowned. After 50 years, he still bridled at being called Willie. In Los Angeles, he was Big Bill Borden. When he returned to his native Germany, which was not often because of the dangers involved, he was once again Wilhelm von Borchert, Lord of Dark Manor, Forest, and Hunt. But Nina had called him Willie when they had first met in 1931 in Vienna, and Willie he had remained.
"You begin, Willie dear," said Nina. "You go first."
I could remember the time when we would have spent the first few days of our reunion in conversation and catching up with one another's lives. Now there was not even time for small talk. Willie showed his teeth and removed news clippings, notebooks, and a stack of cassettes from his briefcase. No sooner had he covered the small table with his material than Mr. Thorne arrived with the tea and Nina's scrapbook from the sewing room. Willie brusquely cleared a small space. At first glance, one might see certain similarities between Willie Borchert and Mr. Thorne. One would be mistaken. Both men tended to the florid, but Willie's complexion was the result of excess and emotion. Mr. Thorne had known neither of these for many years. Willie's balding was a patchy, self-consciously concealed thing, a weasel with mange. Mr. Thorne's bare head was smooth and unwrinkled. One could not imagine Mr. Thorne ever having had hair. Both men had gray eyes, what a novelist would call cold gray eyes, but Mr. Thorne's eyes were cold with indifference. Cold with a clarity coming from an absolute absence of troublesome emotion or thought. Willie's eyes were the cold of a blustery North Sea winter and were often clouded with shifting curtains of the emotions that controlled him. Pride, hatred, love of pain, the pleasures of destruction. Willie never referred to his use of the ability as feedings. I was evidently the only one who thought in those terms, but Willie sometimes talked of the hunt. Perhaps it was the dark forest of his homeland that he thought of as he stalked his human quarry through the sterile streets of Los Angeles. Did Willie dream of the forest, I wondered? Did he look back to green wool hunting jackets, the applause of retainers, the gouts of blood from the dying boar? Or did Willie remember the slam of jackboots on cobblestones and the pounding of his lieutenant's fists on doors? Perhaps Willie still associated his hunt with a dark European night of the ovens that he had helped to oversee. I called it feeding. Willie called it the hunt. I had never heard Nina call it anything. "Where is your VCR?" Willie asked. "I have put them all on tape."
"Oh, Willie," said Nina in an exasperated tone.
"You know Melanie. She's so old-fashioned. You know she wouldn't have a video player.
I don't even have a television, I said. Nina laughed.
God damn it, muttered Willie. It doesn't matter. I have other records here.
He snapped rubber bands from around the small black notebooks.
It just would have been better on tape. The Los Angeles stations gave much coverage to the Hollywood Strangler, and I edited in the... Ugh, never mind.
He tossed the video cassettes into his briefcase and slammed the lid shut. 23, he said. 23 since we met 12 months ago. It doesn't seem that long, does it?
Show us, said Nina.
She was leaning forward, and her blue eyes seemed very bright.
I've been wondering since I saw the Strangler interviewed on 60 Minutes. He was yours, Willie. He seemed so...
Yeah, he was mine. A nobody. A timid little man.
He was the gardener of a neighbor of mine. I left him alive so that the police could question him, erase any doubts.
He will hang himself in his cell next month after the press loses interest. But this... He's more interesting. Look at this.
Willie slid across several glossy black and white photographs. The NBC executive had murdered the 5 members of his family and drowned a visiting soap opera actress in his pool. He had then stabbed himself repeatedly and written 50 share in blood on the wall of the bathhouse.
Reliving old glories, Willie? Asked Nina. Death to the pigs and all that?
No, goddammit. I think I should receive points for irony. The girl had been scheduled to drown on the program. It was already in the script outline.
Was he hard to use?
It was my question. I was curious despite myself.
Willie lifted one eyebrow.
Not really. He was an alcoholic and heavily into cocaine.
There was not much left, and he hated his family. Most people do.
Most people in California, perhaps, said Nina primly.
It was an odd comment from Nina. Years ago, her father had committed suicide by throwing himself in front of a trolley car.
Where did you make contact? I asked.
A party? The usual place.
He bought the coke from a director who had ruined one of my...
Did you have to repeat the contact?
Willie frowned at me. He kept his anger under control, but his face grew redder.
Yeah, I saw him thrice more. Once I just watched from my car as he played tennis.
Points for irony, said Nina, but you lose points for repeated contact. If he were as empty as you say, you should have been able to use him after only one touch. What else do you have?
He had his usual assortment. Pathetic Skid Row murders, 2 domestic slayings, a highway collision that turned into a fatal shooting.
I was in the crowd, said Willie. I made contact. He had a gun in the glove compartment.
2 points, said Nina.
Willie had saved a good one for last. A once-famous child star had suffered a bizarre accident. He had left his Bel Air apartment while it filled with gas, and then returned to light a match. 2 others had died in the ensuing fire.
You get credit only for him, said Nina.
Yeah.
Are you absolutely sure about this one? It could have been an accident.
Don't be ridiculous, snapped Willie.
He turned toward me.
This one was very hard to use, very strong. I blocked his memory of turning on the gas. Had to hold it away for 2 hours, then forced him into the room. He struggled not to light the match.
You should have had him use his lighter, said Nina.
He didn't smoke, growled Willie. He gave it up last year.
Yes, smiled Nina. I seem to remember him saying that to Johnny Carson.
I could not tell whether Nina was jesting. The three of us went through the ritual of assigning points. Nina did most of the talking. Willie went from being sullen to expansive to sullen again. At one point, he reached over and patted my knee as he laughingly asked for my support. I said nothing. Finally, he gave up, crossed the parlor to the liquor cabinet, and poured himself a tall glass of bourbon from Father's decanter. The evening light was sending its final horizontal rays through the stained glass panels of the bay windows, and it cast a red hue on Willie as he stood next to the oak cupboard. His eyes were small red embers in a bloody mask. 41, said Nina at last. She looked up brightly and showed the calculator as if it verified some objective fact. I count 41 points. What do you have, Melanie?
Yah, interrupted Willie. That is fine. Now let us see your claims, Nina.
His voice was flat and empty. Even Willie had lost some interest in the game. Before Nina could begin, Mr. Thorne entered in motion that dinner was served. We adjourned to the dining room, Willie pouring himself another glass of bourbon, and Nina fluttering her hands in mock frustration at the interruption of the game. Once seated at the long mahogany table, I worked at being a hostess. From decades of tradition, talk of the game was banned from the dinner table. Over soup, we discussed Willie's new movie and the purchase of another store for Nina's line of boutiques. It seemed that Nina's monthly column in Vogue was to be discontinued, but that a newspaper syndicate was interested in picking it up. Both of my guests exclaimed over the perfection of the baked ham, but I thought that Mr. Thorne had made the gravy a trifle too sweet. Darkness had filled the windows before we finished our chocolate mousse. The refracted light from the chandelier made Nina's hair dance with highlights, while I feared that mine glowed more bluely than ever. Suddenly, there was a sound from the kitchen. The huge Negro's face appeared at the swinging door. His shoulder was hunched against white hands, and his expression was that of a querulous child.
"The hell you think we're sitting here like goddamn—"
The white hands pulled him out of sight.
"Excuse me, ladies."
Willie dabbed linen at his lips and stood up. He still moved gracefully for all of his years. Nina poked at her chocolate. There was one sharp, barked command from the kitchen and the sound of a slap. It was the slap of a man's hand, hard and flat as a small-caliber rifle shot. I looked up and Mr. Thorne was at my elbow, clearing away the dessert dishes.
"Coffee, please, Mr. Thorne, for all of us."
He nodded and his smile was gentle. Franz Anton Mesmer had known of it even if he had not understood it. I suspect that Mesmer must have had some small touch of the ability. Modern pseudosciences have studied it and renamed it, removed most of its power, confused its uses and origins, but it remained the shadow of what Mesmer discovered. They have no idea of what it is like to feed. I despair at the rise of modern violence. I truly give in to despair at times, that deep, futureless pit of despair that poet Gerard Manley Hopkins called carrion comfort. I watch the American slaughterhouse, the casual attacks on popes, presidents, and uncounted others, and I wonder whether there are many more out there with the ability, or whether butchery has simply become the modern way of life. All humans feed on violence, on the small exercises of power over another. But few have tasted, as we have, the ultimate power. And without the ability, few know the unequaled pleasure of taking a human life. Without the ability, even those who do feed on life cannot savor the flow of emotions in stalker and victim, the total exhilaration of the attacker who has moved beyond all rules and punishments, the strange, almost sexual submission of the victim in that final second of truth, when all options are canceled, all futures denied, all possibilities erased in an exercise of absolute power over another. I despair at modern violence. I despair at the impersonal nature of it, and the casual quality that has made it accessible to so many. I had a television set until I sold it at the height of the Vietnam War. Those sanitized snippets of death, made distant by the camera lens, meant nothing to me. But I believe it meant something to these cattle that surround me. When the war and the nightly televised body counts ended, they demanded more. More. And the movie screens and streets of this sweet and dying nation have provided it in mediocre mob abundance. It is an addiction I know well. They miss the point. Merely observed, violent death is a sad and sullied tapestry of confusion. But to those of us who have fed, death can be a sacrament.
My turn, my turn!
Nina's voice still resembled that of a visiting belle who had just filled her dance card at Cousin Celia's June ball. We had returned to the parlor. Willie had finished his coffee and requested a brandy from Mr. Thorne. I was embarrassed for Willie. To have one's closest associates show any hint of unplanned behavior was certainly a sign of weakening ability. Nina did not appear to have noticed.
I have them all in order, said Nina.
She opened the scrapbook on the now empty tea table. Willie went through them carefully, sometimes asking a question, more often grunting assent. I murmured occasional agreement, although I had heard of none of them. Except for the beetle, of course. Nina saved that for near the end.
Good God, Nina, that was you?
Willie seemed near anger. Nina's feedings had always run to Park Avenue suicides and matrimonial disagreements ending in shots fired from expensive small-caliber ladies' guns. This type of thing was more in Willie's crude style. Perhaps he felt that his territory was being invaded.
I mean, you were risking a lot, weren't you? It's so... damn it, so public!
Nina laughed and set down the calculator.
Willie, dear, that's what the game is about, is it not?
Willie strode to the liquor cabinet and refilled his brandy snifter. The wind tossed bare branches against the leaded glass of the bay window. I do not like winter. Even in the South, it takes its toll on the spirit.
Didn't this guy, what's his name, buy the gun in Hawaii or someplace?
Asked Willie from across the room.
That sounds like his initiative to me. I mean, if he was already stalking the fellow. Willie, dear.
Nina's voice had gone as cold as the wind that raked the branches.
No one said he was stable. How many of yours are stable, Willie? But I made it happen, darling. I chose the place and the time. Don't you see the irony of the place, Willie? After that little prank on the director of that witchcraft movie a few years ago? It was straight from the script.
I don't know, said Willie. He sat heavily on the divan, spilling brandy on his expensive sports coat. He did not notice. The lamplight reflected from his balding skull. The models of age were more visible at night, and his neck, where it disappeared into his turtleneck, was all ropes and tendons.
I don't know.
He looked up at me and smiled suddenly, as if we shared a conspiracy.
It could be like that writer fellow, eh, Melanie? It could be like that.
Nina looked down at the hands in her lap. They were clenched, and the well-manicured fingers were white at the tips. The Mind Vampires. That's what the writer was going to call his book. I sometimes wonder if he really would have written anything. What was his name? Something Russian. Willie and I received telegrams from Nina. Come quickly, you are needed. That was enough. I was on the next morning's flight to New York. The plane was a noisy, propeller-driven constellation, and I spent much of the flight assuring the overly solicitous stewardess that I needed nothing, that indeed I felt fine. She obviously had decided that I was someone's grandmother who was flying for the first time. Willie managed to arrive 20 minutes before me. Nina was distraught and as close to hysteria as I had ever seen her. She had been at a party in Lower Manhattan 2 days before. She was not so distraught that she forgot to tell us what important names had been there when she found herself sharing a corner, a fondue pot, and confidences with a young writer. Or rather, the writer was sharing confidences. Nina described him as a scruffy sort with a wispy little beard, thick glasses, a corduroy sports coat worn over an old plaid shirt, one of the type invariably sprinkled around successful parties of that era, according to Nina. She knew enough not to call him a beatnik, for that term had just become passé, but no one had yet heard the term hippie, and it wouldn't have applied to him anyway. He was a writer of the sort that barely ekes out a living, these days at least, by selling blood and doing novelizations of television series. Alexander something. His idea for a book, he told Nina that he had been working on it for some time, was that many of the murders then being committed were actually the result of a small group of psychic killers, he called them mind vampires, who used others to carry out their grisly deeds. He said that a paperback publisher had already shown interest in his outline and would offer him a contract tomorrow if he would change the title to The Zombie Factor and put in more sex.
So what? Willie had said to Nina in disgust. You have me fly across the continent for this? I might buy the idea myself.
That turned out to be the excuse we used to interrogate this Alexander somebody during an impromptu party given by Nina the next evening. I did not attend. The party was not overly successful, according to Nina, but it gave Willie the chance to have a long chat with the young would-be novelist. In the writer's almost pitiable eagerness to do business with Bill Borden, producer of Paris Memories, Three on a Swing, and at least two other completely forgettable Technicolor features touring the drive-ins that summer, he revealed that the book consisted of a well-worn outline and a dozen pages of notes. He was sure, however, that he could do a treatment for Mr. Borden in 5 weeks, perhaps even as fast as 3 weeks if he were flown out to Hollywood to get the proper creative stimulation. Later that evening, we discussed the possibility of Willie simply buying an option on the treatment. But Willie was short on cash at the time, and Nina was insistent. In the end, the young writer opened his femoral artery with a Gillette blade and ran screaming into a narrow Greenwich Village side street to die. I don't believe that anyone ever bothered to sort through the clutter and debris of his remaining notes.
It could be like that writer, yeah, Melanie?
Willie patted my knee. I nodded. He was mine, continued Willie, and Nina tried to take credit, remember? Again, I nodded.
Actually, it had been neither Nina's nor Willie's. I had avoided the party so that I could make contact later without the young man noticing he was being followed. I did so easily. I remember sitting in an overheated little delicatessen across the street from the apartment building. It was over so quickly that there was almost no sense of feeding. Then I was aware once again of the sputtering radiators and the smell of salami as people rushed to the door to see what the screaming was about. I remember finishing my tea slowly so that I did not have to leave before the ambulance was gone.
"Nonsense," said Nina. She busied herself with her little calculator. "How many points?"
She looked at me. I looked at Willie.
6.
He said with a shrug. Nina made a small show of totaling the numbers.
38,
she said, and sighed theatrically. You win again, Willie. Or rather, you beat me again. We must hear from you, Melanie. You've been so quiet, dear. You must have some surprise for us.
Yes, said Willie. It is your turn to win. It has been several years.
None, I said. I had expected an explosion of questions, but the silence was broken only by the ticking of the clock on the mantelpiece. Nina was looking away from me, as something hidden by the shadows in the corner.
None?
Echoed Willie. There was one, I said at last. But it was by accident. I came across them robbing an old man behind, but it was completely by accident. Willie was agitated. He stood up, walked to the window, turned an old straight-back chair around, and straddled it, arms folded.
What does this mean?
You're quitting the game? Nina asked as she turned to look at me. I let the question serve as the answer.
Why?
Snapped Willie. In his excitement, it came out with a hard V. If I had been raised in an era when young ladies were allowed to shrug, I would have done so. As it was, I contented myself with running my fingers along an imaginary seam on my skirt. Willie had asked the question, but I stared straight into Nina's eyes when I finally answered,
I'm tired. It's been too long. I guess I'm getting old.
You'll get a lot older if you do not hunt, said Willie. His body, his voice, the red mask of his face, everything signaled great anger just kept in check.
My God, Melanie, you already look older. You look terrible. This is why we hunt, woman. Look at yourself in the mirror. Do you want to die an old woman just because you're tired of using them?
Willie stood and turned his back.
Nonsense!
Nina's voice was strong, confident, in command once more.
Melanie's tired, Willie. Be nice. We all have times like that. I remember how you were after the war, like a whipped puppy. You wouldn't even go outside your miserable little flat in Baden. Even after we helped you get to New Jersey, you just sulked around feeling sorry for yourself. Melanie made up the game to help you feel better. So quiet. Never tell a lady who feels tired and depressed that she looks terrible. Honestly, Willie, you're such a spasaniga sometimes. And a crashing bore to boot.
I had anticipated many reactions to my announcement, but this was the one I feared most. It meant that Nina had also tired of the game. It meant that she was ready to move to another level of play. It had to mean that. Thank you, Nina, darling, I said. I knew you would understand. She reached across and touched my knee reassuringly. Even through my wool skirt, I could feel the cold of her fingers.
My guests would not stay the night. I implored. I remonstrated. I pointed out that their rooms were ready, that Mr. Thorne had already turned down the quilts.
Next time, said Willie. Next time, Melanie, my little love. We'll make a weekend of it, as we used to. A week.
Willie was in a much better mood since he had been paid his $1,000 prize by each of us. He had sulked, but I had insisted. It soothed his ego when Mr. Thorne brought in a check already made out to William D. Borden. Again, I asked him to stay, but he protested that he had a midnight flight to Chicago. He had to see a prize-winning author about a screenplay. Then he was hugging me goodbye. His companions were in the hall behind me, and I had a brief moment of terror. But they left. The blonde young man showed his white smile, and the Negro bobbed his head in what I took as a farewell. Then we were alone. Nina and I were alone. Not quite alone. Miss Kramer was standing next to Nina at the end of the hall. Mr. Thorne was out of sight behind the swinging door to the kitchen. I left him there. Miss Kramer took 3 steps forward. I felt my breath stop for an instant. Mr. Thorne put his hand on the swinging door. Then the husky little brunette opened the door to the hall closet, removed Nina's coat, and stepped back to help her into it.
Are you sure you won't stay?
No, thank you, darling. I've promised Barrett that we would drive to Hilton Head tonight.
But it's late.
We have reservations. Thank you anyway, Melanie. I will be in touch.
Yes.
I mean it, dear. We must talk. I understand exactly how you feel, but you have to remember that the game is still important to Willie. We'll have to find a way to end it without hurting his feelings. Perhaps we could visit him next spring in Karin Hall, or whatever he calls that gloomy old Bavarian place of his. A trip to the continent would do wonders for you, dear.
Yes.
I will be in touch. After this deal with the new store is settled, we need to spend some time together, Melanie. Just the two of us. Like old times.
Her lips kissed the air next to my cheek. She held my forearms tightly.
Goodbye, darling.
Goodbye, Nina.
I carried the brandy glass to the kitchen. Mr. Thorne took it in silence.
Make sure the house is secure, I said.
He nodded and went to check the locks and alarm system. It was only 9:45, but I was very tired. Age, I thought. I went up the wide staircase, perhaps the finest feature of the house, and dressed for bed. It had begun to storm, and the sound of the cold raindrops on the window carried a sad rhythm to it. Mr. Thorne looked in as I was brushing my hair and wishing it were longer. I turned to him. He reached into the pocket of his dark vest. When his hand emerged, a slim blade flicked out. I nodded. He palmed the blade shut and closed the door behind him. I listened to his footsteps recede down the stairs to the chair in the front hall where he would spend the night. I believe I dreamed of vampires that night. Or perhaps I was thinking about them just prior to falling asleep, and a fragment had stayed with me until morning. Of all mankind's self-inflicted terrors, of all its pathetic little monsters, only the myth of the vampire had any vestige of dignity. Like the humans it feeds on, the vampire must respond to its own dark compulsions. But unlike its petty human prey, the vampire carries out its sordid means to the only possible ends that could justify such actions, the goal of literal immortality. There is a nobility there, and a sadness.
Before sleeping, I thought of that summer long ago in Vienna. I saw Willie young again, blonde, flushed with youth, and filled with pride at escorting two such independent American ladies. I remembered Willie's high, stiff collars and the short dresses that Nina helped to bring into style that summer. I remembered the friendly sounds of crowded beer gardens and the shadowy dance of leaves in front of gas lamps. I remembered the footsteps on wet cobblestones, the shouts, the distant whistles, and the silences. Willie was right. I had aged. The past year had taken a greater toll than the preceding decade. But I had not fed. Despite the hunger, despite the aging reflection in the mirror, I had not fed. I fell asleep trying to think of that writer's last name. I fell asleep hungry. Morning. Bright sunlight through bare branches. It was one of those crystalline, warming winter days that makes living in the South so much less depressing than merely surviving a Yankee winter. I had Mr. Thorne open the window a crack when he brought in my breakfast tray. As I sipped my coffee, I could hear children playing in the courtyard. Once Mr. Thorne would have brought the morning paper with the tray, but I had long since learned that to read about the follies and scandals of the world was to desecrate the morning. I was growing less and less interested in the affairs of men. I had done without a newspaper, telephone, or television for 12 years, and had suffered no ill effects, unless one were to count a growing self-contentment as an ill thing. I smiled as I remembered Willie's disappointment at not being able to play his video cassettes. He was such a child. "It is Saturday, is it not, Mr. Thorne?" At his nod, I gestured for the tray to be taken away. "We will go out today," I said. "A walk. Perhaps a trip to the fort. Then dinner at Henry's and home. I have arrangements to make." Mr. Thorne hesitated and half stumbled as he was leaving the room. I paused in the act of belting my robe. It was not like Mr. Thorne to commit an ungraceful movement. I realized that he, too, was getting old. He straightened the tray and dishes, nodded his head, and left for the kitchen. I would not let thoughts of aging disturb me on such a beautiful morning. I felt charged with a new energy and resolve. The reunion the night before had not gone well, but neither had it gone as badly as it might have. I had been honest with Nina and Willie about my intention of quitting the game. In the weeks and months to come, they, or at least Nina, would begin to brood over the ramifications of that. But by the time they chose to react, separately or together, I would be long gone. Already I had new and old identities waiting for me in Florida, Michigan, London, southern France, and even in New Delhi. Michigan was out for the time being. I had grown unused to the harsh climate. New Delhi was no longer the hospitable place for foreigners it had been when I resided there, briefly before the war. Nina had been right about one thing. A return to Europe would be good for me. Already I longed for the rich light and cordial savoir-vivre of the villages near my old summer house outside of Toulon. The air outside was bracing. I wore a simple print dress in my spring coat. The trace of arthritis in my right leg had bothered me coming down the stairs, but I used my father's old walking stick as a cane. A young Negro servant had cut it for Father the summer we moved from Greenville to Charleston. I smiled as we emerged into the warm air of the courtyard. Mrs. Hodges came out of a doorway into the light. It was her grandchildren and their friends who were playing around the dry fountain. For 2 centuries, the courtyard had been shared by the 3 brick buildings. Only my home had not been parceled into expensive townhouses or fancy apartments.
Good morning, Miss Fuller.
Good morning, Mrs. Hodges. A beautiful day, isn't it?
It is that. Are you off shopping?
Just for a walk, Mrs. Hodges. I'm surprised that Mr. Hodges isn't out today. He always seems to be working in the yard on Saturdays.
Mrs. Hodges frowned as one of the little girls ran between us. Her friend came squealing after her, sweater flying.
Oh, George is at the marina already.
In the daytime?
I had often been amused by Mr. Hodges' departure for work in the evening, his security guard uniform neatly pressed, gray hair jutting from under his cap, black lunch pail gripped firmly under his arm. Mr. Hodges was as leathery and bow-legged as an aged cowboy. He was one of those men who were always on the verge of retiring, but who would probably realize that to be suddenly inactive would be a form of death sentence.
Oh, yes. One of those colored men on the day shift down at the storage building quit, and they asked George to fill in. I told him that he was too old to work full nights a week and then go back on the weekend, but you know George, he'll never retire.
Well, give him my best, I said.
The girls running around the fountain made me nervous. Mrs. Hodges followed me to the wrought iron gate.
Will you be going away for the holidays, Miss Fuller?
Probably, Mrs. Hodges. Most probably.
Then Mr. Thorne and I were out on the sidewalk and strolling toward the Battery. A few cars drove slowly down the narrow streets. Some tourists stared at the houses of our old section, but the day was serene and quiet. I saw the masts of the yachts and sailboats before we came in sight of the water as we emerged onto Broad Street.
"Please acquire tickets for us, Mr. Thorne," I said. "I believe I would like to see the fort."
As is typical of most people who live in close proximity to a popular tourist attraction, I had not taken notice of it for many years. It was an act of sentimentality to visit the fort now, an act brought on by my increasing acceptance of the fact that I would have to leave these parts forever. It is one thing to plan a move. It is something altogether different to be faced with the imperative reality of it. There were few tourists. The ferry moved away from the marina and into the placid waters of the harbor. The combination of warm sunlight and the steady throb of the diesel caused me to doze briefly. I awoke as we were putting in at the dark hulk of the island fort. For a while, I moved with the tour group, enjoying the catacomb silences of the lower levels and the mindless sing-song of the young woman from the park service. But as we came back to the museum, with its dusty dioramas and tawdry little trays of slides, I climbed the stairs back to the outer walls. I motioned for Mr. Thorne to stay at the top of the stairs and moved out onto the ramparts. Only one other couple, a young pair with a cheap camera and a baby in an uncomfortable-looking papoose carrier, were in sight along the wall. It was a pleasant moment. A midday storm was approaching from the west, and it set a dark backdrop to the still, sunlit church spires, brick towers, and bare branches of the city. Even from 2 miles away, I could see the movement of the people strolling along the Battery walkway. The wind was blowing in ahead of the dark clouds and tossing white caps against the rockin' ferry and wooden dock. The air smelled of river and winter and rain by nightfall. It was not hard to imagine that day long ago. The shells had dropped onto the fort until the upper layers were little more than protective piles of rubble. People had cheered from the rooftops behind the Battery. The bright colors of dresses and silk parasols must have been maddening to the Yankee gunners. Finally, one had fired a shot above the crowded rooftops. The ensuing confusion must have been amusing from this vantage point. A movement down below caught my attention. Something dark was sliding through the gray water. Something dark and shark silent. I was jolted out of thoughts of the past as I recognized it as a Polaris submarine. Old, but obviously still operational, slipping through the dark water without a sound. Waves curled and rippled over the porpoise smooth hull, sliding to either side in a white wake. There were several men on the tower. They were muffled in heavy coats, their hats pulled low. An improbably large pair of binoculars hung from the neck of one man, whom I assumed to be the captain. He pointed at something beyond Sullivan's Island. I stared. The periphery of my vision began to fade as I made contact. Sounds and sensations came to me as from a distance. Tension. The pleasure of salt spray. Breeze from the north, northwest. Anxiety of the sealed orders below. Awareness of the sandy shallows just coming into sight on the port side. I was startled as someone came up behind me. The dots flickering at the edge of my vision fled as I turned. Mr. Thorne was there, at my elbow, unbidden. I had opened my mouth to command him back to the top of the stairs when I saw the cause of his approach. The youth who had been taking pictures of his pale wife was now walking toward me. Mr. Thorne moved to intercept him. "Hey, excuse me, ma'am. Would you or your husband mind taking our picture?" I nodded, and Mr. Thorne took the proffered camera. It looked minuscule in his long-fingered hands. Two snaps and the couple were satisfied that their presence there was documented for posterity. The young man grinned idiotically and bobbed his head. Their baby began to cry as the cold wind blew in. I looked back to the submarine, but already it had passed on, its gray tower a thin stripe connecting the sea and sky. We were almost back to town. The ferry was swinging in toward the ship when a stranger told me of Willie's death.
"It's awful, isn't it?"
The garrulous old woman had followed me out onto the exposed section of deck. Even though the wind had grown chilly and I had moved twice to escape her mindless chatter, the woman had obviously chosen me as her conversational target for the final stages of the tour. Neither my reticence nor Mr. Thorne's glowering presence had discouraged her.
"It must have been terrible," she continued. "In the dark and all?"
What was that? A dark premonition prompted my question.
"Why, the airplane crash. Haven't you heard about it? It must have been awful falling into the swamp and all. I told my daughter this morning."
"What airplane crash? When?" The old woman cringed a bit at the sharpness of my tone, but the vacuous smile stayed on her face.
"Why, last night. This morning I told my daughter..."
"Where? What aircraft are you talking about?" Mr. Thorne came closer as he heard the tone of my voice.
The one last night," she quavered. "The one from Charleston? The paper in the lounge told all about it. Isn't it terrible? 85 people? I told my daughter..."
I left her standing there by the railing. There was a crumpled newspaper near the snack bar, and under the four-word headline were the sparse details of Willie's death. Flight 417, bound for Chicago, had left Charleston International Airport at 12:18 a.m. 20 minutes later, the aircraft had exploded in mid-air, not far from the city of Columbia. Fragments of fuselage and parts of bodies had fallen into the Congaree swamp, where fishermen had found them. There had been no survivors. The FAA and FBI were investigating. There was a loud rushing in my ears, and I had to sit down or faint. My hands were clammy against the green vinyl upholstery.
People move past me on their way to the exits.
Willie was dead. Murdered. Nina had killed him. For a few dizzy seconds, I considered the possibility of a conspiracy, an elaborate ploy by Nina and Willie to confuse me into thinking that only one threat remained. But no, there would be no reason. If Nina had included Willie in her plans, there would be no need for such absurd machinations. Willie was dead. His remains were spread over a smelly, obscure marshland. I could imagine his last moments. He would have been leaning back in first-class comfort, a drink in his hand, perhaps whispering to one of his loutish companions. Then the explosion, screams, sudden darkness, a brutal tilting and the final fall to oblivion. I shuddered. And I gripped the metal arm of the chair. How had Nina done it? Almost certainly not one of Willie's entourage. It was not beyond Nina's powers to use Willie's own cat's paws, especially in light of his failing ability, but there would have been no reason to do so. She could have used anyone on that flight. It would have been difficult. The elaborate step of preparing the bomb? The supreme effort of blocking all memory of it? And the almost unbelievable feat of using someone even as we sat together drinking coffee and brandy? But Nina could have done it. Yes, she could have. And the timing could mean only one thing. The last of the Taurus had filed out of the cabin. I felt the slight bump that meant we had tied up to the dock. Mr. Thorne stood by the door. Nina's timing meant that she was attempting to deal with both of us at once. She obviously had planned it long before the reunion and my timorous announcement of withdrawal. How amused Nina must have been. No wonder she had reacted so generously. Yet, she had made one great mistake. By dealing with Willie first, Nina had banked everything on my not hearing the news before she could turn on me. She knew that I had no access to daily news, and only rarely left the house anymore. Still, it was unlike Nina to leave anything a chance. Was it possible that she thought I had lost the ability completely, and that Willie was the greater threat? I shook my head as we emerged from the cabin into the gray afternoon light. The wind sliced at me through my thin coat. The view of the gangplank was blurry, and I realized that tears had filled my eyes. For Willie? He had been a pompous, weak old fool. For Nina's betrayal? Perhaps it was only the cold wind. The streets of the old section were almost empty of pedestrians. Bare branches clicked together in front of the windows of fine homes. Mr. Thorne stayed by my side. The cold air sent needles of arthritic pain up my right leg to my hip. I leaned more heavily upon Father's walking stick. What would her next move be? I stopped. A fragment of newspaper, caught by the wind, wrapped itself around my ankle and then blew on. How would she come at me? Not from a distance. She was somewhere in town. I knew that. While it is possible to use someone from a great distance, it would involve great rapport, an almost intimate knowledge of that person. And if contact were lost, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to reestablish at a distance. None of us had known why this was so. It did not matter now. But the thought of Nina still here, nearby, made my heart begin to race. Not from a distance. I would see my assailant. If I knew Nina at all, I knew that.
Certainly Willie's death had been the least personal feat imaginable, but that had been a mere technical operation. Nina obviously had decided to settle old scores with me, and Willie had become an obstacle to her, a minor but measurable threat that had to be eliminated before she could proceed. I could easily imagine that in Nina's own mind, her choice of death for Willie would be interpreted as an act of compassion, almost a sign of affection. Not so with me. I felt that Nina would want me to know, however briefly, that she was behind the attack. In a sense, her own vanity would be my warning. Or so I hoped. I was tempted to leave immediately. I could have Mr. Thorne get the Audi out of storage, and we could be beyond Nina's influence in an hour, away to a new life within a few more hours. There were important items in the house, of course, but the funds that I had stored elsewhere would replace most of them. It would be almost welcome to leave everything behind with the discarded identity that had accumulated them. No, I could not leave. Not yet. From across the street, the house looked dark and malevolent. Had I closed those blinds on the second floor? There was a shadowy movement in the courtyard, and I saw Mrs. Hodges' granddaughter and a friend scamper from one doorway to another. I stood irresolutely on the curb and tapped Father's stick against the black bark tree. It was foolish to dither so. I knew it was, but it had been a long time since I had been forced to make a decision under stress. "Mr. Thorne, please check the house. Look in each room. Return quickly." A cold wind came up as I watched Mr. Thorne's black coat blend into the gloom of the courtyard. I felt terribly exposed standing there alone. I found myself glancing up and down the street, looking for Miss Kramer's dark hair, but the only sign of movement was a young woman pushing a perambulator far down the street. The blinds on the second floor shot up, and Mr. Thorne's face stared out whitely for a minute. Then he turned away, and I remained staring at the dark rectangle of window. A shout from the courtyard startled me, but it was only the little girl, what was her name, calling to a friend. Kathleen, that was it. The two sat on the edge of the fountain and opened a box of animal crackers. I stared intently at them and then relaxed. I even managed to smile a little at the extent of my paranoia. For a second, I considered using Mr. Thorne directly, but the thought of being helpless on the street dissuaded me. When one is in complete contact, the senses still function, but are a distant thing at best. "Hurry." The thought was sent almost without volition. Two bearded men were walking down the sidewalk on my side of the street. I crossed to stand in front of my own gate. The men were laughing and gesturing at each other. One looked over at me. "Hurry." Mr. Thorne came out of the house, locked the door behind him, and crossed the courtyard toward me. One of the girls said something to him and held out the box of crackers, but he ignored her. Across the street, the two men continued walking. Mr. Thorne handed me the large front door key. I dropped it in my coat pocket and looked sharply at him. He nodded. His placid smile unconsciously mocked my consternation. "You're sure?" I asked. Again the nod. "You checked all of the rooms?" Nod. "The alarms?" Nod. "You looked in the basement?" Nod. "No sign of disturbance?" Mr. Thorne shook his head. My hand went to the metal of the gate, but I hesitated. Anxiety filled my throat like bile. I was a silly old woman, tired and aching from the chill, but I could not bring myself to open that gate. "Come." I crossed the street and walked briskly away from the house. "We will have dinner at Henry's and return later." Only I was not walking toward the old restaurant. I was heading away from the house in what I knew was a blind, directionless panic. It was not until we reached the waterfront and we were walking along the Battery Wall that I began to calm down. No one else was in sight. A few cars moved along the street, but to approach us, someone would have to cross a wide, empty space. The gray clouds were quite low and blended with the choppy, white-crested waves in the bay. The open air and fading evening light served to revive me, and I began to think more clearly. Whatever Nina's plans had been, they certainly had been thrown into disarray by my day-long absence. I doubted that Nina would stay if there were the slightest risk to herself.